in London to Handel's house. Then at 2 o'clock this afternoon, the Califax Reed Quintet provides the music in our lunchtime concert. They gave a recital at Wigmore Hall last Monday, which formed our regular live lunchtime concert, and there's a second chance to hear that concert at 2 this afternoon. But first, before all that, this is Ian Skelly with a summary of the BBC News here on Radio 3 this lunchtime. The Environment Secretary, Owen Paterson, has warned that the contamination of beef products with horse meat could be the result of an international criminal conspiracy. He's hosting an emergency meeting with the Food Standards Agency and retailers. The supermarket chain Aldi has followed Findus in withdrawing a number of ready meals, which were found in some cases to be entirely made from horse meat. Prosecutors have defended the handling of an abuse case in which the victim killed herself after giving evidence. Frances Andrade, who was 48, was found dead at her home. Yesterday, her former teacher, 68-year-old Michael Brewer, was convicted of indecently assaulting her when she was a pupil at Cheetham's Music School in Manchester in the 1970s. His ex-wife, Kay, was also found guilty of indecent assault. The Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, is expected to tell MPs next week that elderly people in England will have to pay no more than £75,000 for their long-term social care. The cap is much higher than the £35,000 proposed by the Commission established to consider the problem. A 24-year-old man from South Tyneside has appeared before magistrates charged with threatening to kill in connection with a message he allegedly posted on Facebook. Rhys Elliott from South Shields is accused of saying he would kill 200 people in America, resulting in thousands of pupils staying home from school in Tennessee. Police have also charged him with making malicious communications. At least 5 people have been killed in a rocket and mortar attack on a camp for dissident Iranians in the Iraqi capital Baghdad. The group MEK calls for the overthrow of Iran's clerical leadership, and its members fought alongside Saddam Hussein's troops in the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. Millions of people in the northeastern United States have been warned to stay at home because of a powerful snowstorm which has closed airports and brought down power lines. A state of emergency has been declared in 5 states. The weather here, it'll be a largely cloudy day today with outbreaks of rain. Some sleet or light snow is possible, mainly across central parts of England. The best of any brighter spells are most likely across the Far East. Afternoon temperatures will reach 4 degrees Celsius in London and Edinburgh and 7 in Cardiff and Belfast. And that's the BBC News and the weather. Later this afternoon, we continue with our current series of history-related editions of Saturday Classics. As part of Radio 3 and BBC Two Television's Story of Music series, we've asked 4 notable historians to choose the music that reflects and was shaped by a particular period in history. Today, Bethany Hughes explores the ancient world through the sounds of antiquity. We don't know what musical instruments sounded like then, nor for that matter the music they made with them, but certainly the mythology of ancient Greece and Egypt has caught the imagination of artists down through the ages. And Bethany will be reflecting on that influence with composers from more recent times. But as well as Debussy, Beethoven and Handel, you can also hear some recreations of Greek and Roman music in Saturday Classics at 3 this afternoon here on Radio 3. And it's Handel next. It's time for today's edition of the Early Music Show, which is presented by Catherine Bott.
Hello, I'm in London's West End, looking out of a Georgian first-floor window. This is the house in which Handel wrote a work that's now woven into the tapestry of Englishness, Messiah. But he didn't write it alone. The wordsmith for this uplifting oratorio was a man whose name seems to have ended up being a mere footnote, Charles Jennens. Jennens was a philanthropist, an art collector, and a pioneering editor of the works of Shakespeare. He was librettist of Saul and Belshazzar, as well as Messiah, and he was Handel's friend. I've come to the Handel House Museum to see a new exhibition designed to shed a brighter light on the man who inspired a great composer to some of his greatest work. The chorus and the glory of the Lord from Handel's Messiah, the 16, conducted by Harry Christophers. I'm in the Handel House Museum, gazing up at Thomas Hudson's splendid portrait of Charles Jennens. With me is the best possible guide to the Jennens exhibition, its curator, Handel scholar Ruth Smith. Charles Jennens was born in 1700, and he said of himself that I was born and bred in Leicestershire mud. But looking at him in sumptuous dark velvet and even more sumptuous iridescent pale satin with flouncy cuffs, this is a man of wealth, isn't he, Ruth?
Jennens was certainly wealthy, and this remark about Leicestershire mud is consciously self-deprecating. He actually spent half the year doing the season in London. Yes, he had wealthy origins. His family had become rich through iron manufacture, though by the time Jennens was born, they were landed gentry, and they had moved well away from Birmingham, where their wealth began, over the border into Leicestershire, hence Leicestershire mud.
He has a sensitive face. He's looking slightly reproachfully out at us. A thoughtful man, I think.
Very thoughtful, conflicted, depressive, shy, reserved, open with his friends, a great philanthropist, an immensely generous patron of the arts. He was possibly Handel's most significant, probably most innovative collaborator, and hence the score behind him. He was a tremendous enthusiast for music. This portrait was done in 1747 when he inherited his estates, and it's obviously showing his chief passion in life, music.
He was a Handel addict. You've called him a Handel addict. Handel was his great musical love.
He was a self-admitted Handel addict, he said he was. He said that when he was depressed, Handel's music was what cheered him up. It was his main reason for coming to London during the season. He certainly went to all Handel's performances and supported Handel's career in every way he could.
He never wrote libretti for money, because he didn't need to, and he only wrote them for Handel.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And he wasn't on a vanity trip either. His librettos weren't signed. Librettos were published for people to follow in the theatres, and they were all anonymous. Jennens was, I think, as he saw it, helping to promote great art, but not wanting to put himself in the limelight.
Thank you.
Patrizia Quella and Maldwyn Davis were the singers in that sublime music from Handel's L'Allegro, Il Penseroso and Il Moderato, with the English Baroque soloists conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. And that sublime duet was from Il Moderato, words by Charles Jennens. We're just a couple of turns away from the Hudson portrait of Jennens, and we're in front of a slightly subdued, sort of green-washed country house painting of Jennens's ancestral home, Gopsall Hall.
Jennens's ancestral home transformed by him. This is what he made of the much more humble Jacobean house he was born into. As you see, what Pevsner called the last great example of English Palladianism. And with a great tribute, we can just see over here on the left, to his closest friend Edward Holdsworth. It's through his correspondence with Holdsworth, who was travelling in Italy, that we know a lot about Jennens's thoughts, beliefs, passions. Holdsworth died in 1746, and once Jennens had completed this magnificent house and grounds, on which he spent over 20 years and several million pounds, he put up this little temple to Holdsworth with this amazing statue on it, commissioned from the great sculptor Roubilliac, who of course did the Vauxhall statue of Handel and Handel's memorial in Westminster Abbey, a statue of religion or Christian faith, proclaiming Jennens's faith and his friendship with Holdsworth to the surrounding countryside, very much expressive, I think, of the tension between private and public in Jennens's life.
Looking at this painting here, it does make me extremely sad to note that the house fell into dereliction and was eventually, after the lead had been stolen, it was eventually demolished in 1951. So there's nothing of it left.
In the 1990s, the remains of the temple to Holdsworth were discovered and can still just be seen. And the statue by Roubilliac does survive and is in a small museum at Leicester. I think if the house survived, we would be much more aware of Jennens than we are, though it has to be said it was greatly added to and became the sort of place that Edward VII liked to stay and the cook would have to cycle along the corridors to get from one place to another.
Birth and fortune I despise, birth and fortune I despise, birth and fortune I despise. From virtue let my friendship rise. From virtue. From From virtue let my friendship rise. Birth and fortune I despise, birth and fortune I despise, I despise birth and fortune. From virtue let my friendship rise. From I I despise. From virtue let my friendship rise. From from virtue let my friendship rise.
From the oratorio Saul, that was Jonathan's aria, Birth and Fortune I Despise, sung by Robert Murray from the recording made by Harry Christophers and the 16. Well, Charles Jennens didn't despise his birth and fortune. It brought him a fine classical education. I'm with Ruth Smith, who's the curator of this Jennens exhibition here at the Handel House Museum. Am I right, Ruth? I mean, he really was a very highly educated man.
He was very highly educated. He amassed a stellar library, a most extraordinarily rich collection. And, of course, he knew his Bible very well.
Which informs Saul. We are now standing in front of an autograph score of Saul. Ruth, tell me why this beautiful piece of copying, although slightly messy in places, is in this exhibition.
This is not actually a fair copy. This is Handel's autograph score, that's to say his work in progress score, the final rough copy before it's copied out for him to conduct from at his performances. A priceless document. And what's so extraordinary about it, and about some of his other collaborations with Jennens, is that he actually lent this autograph score to Jennens at a very late stage. An amazing degree of trust. I mean, supposing Jennens' servant had spilt a candle over it and gone up in flames, no more Saul. Another interesting thing about the degree of trust it shows is that Handel allowed Jennens to annotate his music. And that's one of the things we show here, where Jennens has suggested an alteration to an aria to intensify the emotional sense, the emotional impact of it, bringing the voice in before the ritornello, before the orchestral introduction, which is something that Jennens knew that Handel did sometimes to express very strong emotion. So we can actually see here these three extra notes and Jennens's writing for the text Impious Wretch. Now, it has to be said that Handel didn't get this copied out into his conducting score, but some modern conductors do use it, Paul McCreesh, for example, in his recording of Saul, because it is so telling dramatically. In terms of the drama, I think there's no question that Jennens had a huge amount to give Handel in terms of innovation in pushing out the bounds of oratorio. Jennens introduces a real Shakespearean scope to his dramas for Handel, especially Saul. The first scene of conversation in Saul has seven characters in it, six of whom sing solos. The scene goes on, and there's a chorus as well, for 25 minutes. And of course, the end of Saul, the scene of The Witch of Endor, where Saul, having degenerated from a king to a homicidal maniac, in terms of dramatic expressiveness, what Handel wrote for it looks forward, as has been said very often, to not only Weber, but to Wozzeck and Grimes.
Mm-hmm.
wretch that I am, of my own ruin author, where are my own supports? A valiant youth whose very name was terror to my foes, my rage has drove away. Of God forsaken, in vain I ask his counsel, he vouchsafes no answer to the sons of disobedience. Even mine own courage fails me. Can it be his soul become a coward? I'll not believe it. If heaven denies the aid, seek it from hell. Tis said here lives a woman close familiar with the enemy of mankind. Her I'll consult and know the worst. Her art is death thy law, and while I minded law, sure death attended such horrid practices. Yet, oh hard fate, myself am now reduced to ask the counsel of those I once abhorred.
With me, what wouldst thou?
I would that by thy art thou bring me up the man whom I shall name.
Alas! Most household has cut off those who use this art. Wouldst thou ensnare me?
As Jehovah lives, on this account no mischief shall befall thee.
Whom shall I bring up to thee?
Bring up Samuel.
Thank you. the battle. God has forsaken me. No more he answers by prophets or by dreams. No hope remains unless I learn from thee what course to take.
Hath God forsaken thee? And dost thou ask my counsel? Did I not foretell thy fate when madly disobedient thou didst spare the curse of Amalekite, and on the spoil didst fly rapacious? Therefore, God this day hath verified my words in thy destruction. Hath rent the kingdom from thee and bestowed it on David, whom thou hatest for his virtue.
Saul and the Witch of Endor. Christopher Purvis as Saul, Jeremy Budd as the Witch, and Stuart Young as the Ghost of Samuel. Again, from the 16s recording. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott. Today, recorded at the Handel House Museum, a splendid and enlightening exhibition about Handel's oratorio librettist, Charles Jennens, and with me, expert and the exhibition's curator, Ruth Smith. Something that Handel and Jennens really had in common was they were lifelong bachelors, perhaps enjoying a solitary life. I get the impression that Handel took more pleasure in his life than Jennens ever did in his. Jennens was not so comfortable in his skin.
That's absolutely right. Jennens wasn't comfortable in his skin, and he didn't marry, partly, I think, out of shyness. But he obviously loved being with fellow music enthusiasts. He had a special music table built in his room, which opened up into stands for 14 players. So he obviously did chamber music at home, probably playing through some of the parts that he had copied for him of Handel's music.
There's a letter, a copy of a letter, posted on the wall just where we're standing, in which Jennens says, "Mr. Handel's head is more full of maggots than ever." He's writing to a young relative.
That's
about
right,
his
yes.
collaboration with Handel and describing Handel's ideas as maggots.
Well,
not literally.
This is 18th century speak for eccentric notions. It's a nice example, this letter, of a real work in progress meeting in which, again, Handel is willing to take Jennens' ideas on board. One of the maggots that Jennens reports is that Handel has trumped up an alleluia to go at the end of Saul, and Jennens says to him, "This is quite inappropriate. Don't put it there. It's dramatically inapt." And Handel didn't put a hallelujah at the end, and he did put it where Jennens had prescribed it to go at the beginning.
Well, we've already talked about several works. We've mentioned Messiah, we will be returning to that. Il Moderato, words by Jennens, Saul, and there are a couple of other major collaborations to come. One contentious one that we need to perhaps sort out right now is Israel in Egypt. Did Jennens write it?
Well, we really don't know. As we said, he wasn't on a vanity trip. His name doesn't appear on the title pages of any of the librettos. There are good reasons for thinking that he might have collaborated in Israel in Egypt because it has distinct similarities with Messiah. It's scriptural text. All the other oratorios are either a mix of scriptural and paraphrase, or they're entirely paraphrased text, newly invented text. One of the most conclusive things about it suggests possible authorship by Jennings is that when he's talking about his libretto of Messiah, he calls it another scripture collection that I have made for Handel. Now, he may just mean another scripture collection, like Israel in Egypt is a scripture collection, but it does sound rather much as if he's referring to that as something that he also did with Handel. Of course, it may just have been a collaboration. Handel may have said, what about these texts? And then Jennings helped him with them.
But it's quite hard to believe that he wasn't involved in some way, because it's so much up his street. Righteous rejoicing at the end of Handel's Israel in Egypt. The Monteverdi Choir, soloist Elizabeth Priday, and English Baroque soloists conducted by John Elliott Gardner. Ruth, it's time to tackle an aspect of Jennings's religiosity. He wasn't just a lifelong Protestant, evangelizing, proselytizing Christian, and nothing wrong with that. He also was a non-juror.
A non-juror was somebody who refused to take the oaths of loyalty to the Hanoverian regime, which entailed forswearing the previous regime, which was the Stuart kings. Jennings believed in the divine right of kings. He thought that the Hanoverian regime was illegitimate, and indeed, the Hanoverians could be shown to be only 58th in line to the British throne. These oaths were not something superficial, because to have a career in the church, the army, politics, academia, even as a company director, if the company had a royal patent, you had to take these oaths. So all those careers were denied to Jennings, obviously to our gain, because it meant that he could spend his time being a patron of the arts and collaborating with Handel.
So we can be grateful. But you say collaborating with Handel, hang on a minute. Handel was a great proponent and had reason to be rather grateful for the mercy of Hanoverian kings. How did that sit with his relationship with Jennings?
Jennings was clearly not bigoted, which was something that was said about him in his funeral address, that bigotry was abhorrent to him. So he wasn't going to be so petty-minded as to refuse to collaborate with the greatest composer in the world because of some political loyalties. Besides, it must rather have amused Jennings, I think, that he was, as he said, making use of Handel as a conduit, not only for his religious principles, but also, one could say, for his political principles. I mean, here we're standing in front of the libretto of his last collaboration with Handel, Belshazzar. The story of Belshazzar is about the overthrow of Belshazzar in Babylon by Cyrus, king of Persia. Belshazzar has taken the Jews captive. They are living in exile in Babylon. Their temple has been destroyed. They are prisoners there, away from their homeland. Cyrus comes and liberates them, repatriates them, gives them a commission to rebuild their temple. For contemporaries, this would have been wishful thinking about the restoration of all those Jacobite exiles who were wandering around in the continent, Jennings' dear friend Edward Holdsworth amongst them, incidentally.
And you have very pointedly arranged for this word book of Belshazzar to be opened in a glass case next to the front page of the word book for Messiah. And I see a sentence here which is really a bit of a hostage to something. And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. Well, great is the mystery, but it wasn't without controversy, was it?
Oh, you're so right. Yes. Yes. I mean, Messiah is a riposte to the rising tide of skepticism. Scientific discoveries, Enlightenment philosophy, ethical rationalism, the sundering of church and state. These were all issues at Jennings' time which made devout Christians like him feel that the fabric of life was being destroyed. Messiah states that the Christian creed, the Anglican creed, is valid, and especially the mystery of it. Churchmen were responding to rational enlightenment philosophy on its own terms, with reason. Jennings is saying very boldly, no, that's the wrong thing to do. Faith is a mystery, and we should say so, and not be ashamed of it. And so you're right, when he says, without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. Oh yes, there was controversy. In fact, occupying more column interest than anything else in the papers, only Jennings had the inspiration to see that a statement of faith riding, as it were, on Handel's music would be more effective than any number of sermons or tracts. Messiah has survived with Handel's music when all these sermons and tracts are long forgotten.
Thank you.
Caroline Sampson was the soloist in the exhortation to Rejoice Greatly from part one of Messiah, directed by Harry Christophers. Ruth, Messiah was more or less Charles Jennens's idea, wasn't it? And once again, during the process of its creation, he was able to assert himself. I have found a letter that he is a passage from a letter he wrote to his friend Holdsworth, saying of Handel, "He has made a fine entertainment of it, though not near so good as he might and ought to have done. I have with great difficulty made him correct some of the grossest faults in the composition, but he retained his overture obstinately, in which there are some passages far unworthy of Handel, but much more unworthy of the Messiah."
Jennens's tone about Handel is sometimes that of the exasperated schoolteacher dealing with a particularly brilliant but very intransigent pupil. Jennens subscribed to the 18th century belief that great artists have a duty to produce art at the top of their bent, and to convey truths to their audiences in irresistible ways. Jennens was disappointed in Messiah for all sorts of reasons. He did, in fact, manage to effect some changes in Messiah, as he says. And I think one of those was the chorus, "Their sound is gone out." Jennens was a subscribing member of the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, which is what's happening in that chorus. And it wasn't performed at all in Dublin. Those words were not set and were not performed. Then at the first London performance, it was just an aria. And then finally, Jennens, I think, persuaded Handel to set it as the chorus that we know now.
"Their sound is gone out," chorus from Handel's Messiah, Trevor Pinnock directing the English concert. Handel owes Jennens a great debt, and we owe Jennens a great debt, but I don't think we could possibly leave this wonderful exhibition without going to the corner where Hamlet is displayed, Shakespeare's Hamlet, because William Shakespeare owes Jennens a lot too, doesn't he? Jennens wasn't all about being a Handel fan. Tell me about his contribution to Shakespeare scholarship.
There's hardly a branch of the arts in which Jennens didn't proactively engage. His Shakespeare edition was something that he began right at the end of his life. It's amazing and a great testament to his intellectual energy to start a Shakespeare edition when you are in your late 60s and continue it until you die in your early 70s. Jennens is now recognised as a mould-breaking, pioneering editor of Shakespeare. For two reasons. He was the first person ever to produce the plays in single volumes rather than in collections, one play per volume. And he was the first person to produce a variorum edition, that's to say, with notes of the sources for the text actually on the page rather than in, as had been done until then, in separate volumes, often promised but not actually delivered at the end of the collection. Jennens had an absolutely stellar Shakespeare collection. He owned all four first folios and 28 of the quartos that preceded them. So he actually had the material to do an authoritative edition, which was partly his undoing.
Yes, there's a man who really did him down, George Stevens. And he really had it in for Jennens, didn't he?
Stevens in collaboration with no less a person than Samuel Johnson, was engaged on an edition of Shakespeare. Stevens was completely unprincipled. He was a byword in his time for academic malpractice. He plagiarized other editors and then rubbished them in public. He changed editions simply to call in question other editors' texts. He did not want competitors on the scene, and he could see that Jennings' edition was more scholarly than anything that had preceded it, and so he set out to rubbish Jennings. First, in a very nasty review of King Lear, Jennings' first volume, which Jennings was able to riposte. But then, when Jennings rather unwisely produced a very extensive reply,
Stevens... Never do that to a critic.
Yes. Stevens rubbished him even more, traduced him, really. It was a character assassination. Stevens had powerful media contacts, and he was obviously somebody that was quite dangerous to get across. And so it was his version of Jennings that got taken up into biographical surveys and lasts right into the 21st century. A book was published only 5 years ago that used exactly Stevens's terms about Jennings's supposed ostentation. Well, you've seen from the portraits that he's not an ostentatious person. His vanity, his nasty behaviour to his servants, his ridiculous treatment of his equals and his superiors. None of it valid, all of it repeated. We hope that this exhibition will reveal Jennings for who he really was.
Well, I hope so too. There's never been a better place to have an exhibition about Charles Jennings than Handel's own house. And thank you so much, Ruth Smith, for accompanying me round the exhibition with your wisdom. The exhibition is available to attend until April the 14th, 2013, so be there. And Ruth has also written an absolute gem of a book, Charles Jennings, The Man Behind Handel's Messiah, which is available at the Handel House Museum and lots of other good places as well. Can't recommend it too highly.
Thank you.
The chorus by Slow Degrees from Handel's Belshazzar, performed by the English Concert, conducted there by Trevor Pinnock. The Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott, and the programme was produced in Salford by Chris Wines. And you can find a free download of that programme on the Early Music Show pages of the Radio 3 website.
BBC Radio 3's Sunday feature begins a new sequence of programmes exploring the idea of sin. From Primitive Man to Dante's Circles of Hell, Richard Coles explores the ideas of sin and atonement.
Wherever you find human beings, you'll find sin or its cultural equivalent, because we are by nature competitive creatures, and where we compete we cause each other problems, and that calls for some kind of rationalisation and regulation. So I've been looking around some of the tourist sites of Renaissance Italy and much further afield in search of sin and its remedies.
The Sunday feature begins a new three-part series tomorrow night at 7:45 on BBC Radio 3.
In an hour from now on Radio 3, hear what music sounded like in ancient Greece and Rome as the historian Bettany Hughes takes charge of this week's edition of Saturday Classics and considers the impact the music of antiquity had on the music of today. Saturday Classics is at 3 this afternoon. But next, another chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime concert, which was broadcast live here on Radio 3 from Wigmore Hall in London. The presenter was Fiona Talkington.
Towards the end of his life, the composer Jean-Philippe Rameau said how much he regretted having spent so much time on composition, wishing instead he'd carried on exploring music theory, which had really excited him in his youth. I wonder if he'd have felt the same way if he heard his music played today by the inspiring ensemble here at Wigmore Hall this lunchtime. They're a group who breathe new life into everything they do. Audiences fall for them in a big way. And I remember when they first played here a few years ago, someone coming up to me after the concert saying she didn't know that playing like this existed. Well, if you hadn't guessed by now, they are the Califax Reed Quintet from the Netherlands, famous around the world for their brilliant arrangements. They'll be playing Rameau later on. There's some stunning Debussy to come too, and they're going to begin with music by Antoine Brumel, a 15th century composer we know very little about. A guess that he was born in around 1460, probably lived somewhere near Chartres, where he got a job as a singer, and he taught young singers in later years at Notre Dame in Paris. Fame and fortune beckoned him to Italy, and he was last heard of in Rome. But for all this, his beguiling harmonies have inspired musicians ever since, and the Califax Reed Quintet is going to play two pieces. The first motet, Languente Miseris, translates as Languishing in Misery. But don't worry, Nato Canunt Omnia, a joyful Christmas motet which follows, has quirky rhythms which would surely have raised a few eyebrows when it was written. And here are the five musicians now. The Califax Reed Quintet. Oliver Buchhorn playing oboe, Ivar Berets plays clarinet, Rak Hekema on saxophone, Jelte Althuis plays bass clarinet, and Alban Wesley is the bassoonist. They'll also be introducing some of the music.